Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 5th of August 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, today's episode is number 46 and we are still within the Britannic Isles, but we're not actually in Great Britain today. Today we're going to be looking at some Irish history and as well as the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. We also have a special guest with us today. We also have Truthvids with us today. First off, I'll introduce Patriarch. Patriarch, how are you doing? How's life treating you?
Hi, Sven. Yeah, I'm well, thanks. Enjoying the summer. And it's pretty good. Not too bad. Can't complain, really.
We certainly can't. We've certainly had some good weather and we've also have a great guest on the show. As I mentioned before, we have Truthvids with us tonight, who's made a particularly excellent series showing that the Israelites were white. And he's also appeared with William Fink at ChristaGuinea.org with a massive, great long series going into detail with that. And he's with us here today to talk about the Jeremiah legend in Ireland. So Truthvids, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on. Do you just want to let listeners know where they can find your work and the sort of stuff that you're interested in and that you're working on?
Yeah. Hello, Sven. Thanks for having me. We've been speaking, for a few years here and there. And it's nice to finally, you know, come on the show and do something together. That's great. I did 100 Proofs, The Israelites Were White. I did a large compilation, 100 proofs in one video, and it was about an hour and a half, and that was in 2019, I believe. But I realized I could have done a much better job. Once you've done it, you look back and you think, you know what, I could have done that so much better and improved it, and there were a few flaws in it. So I went back and I basically got in touch with William Fink and asked him if he'd be willing to help me. And then that's when we started doing the podcast series. I believe it was like a year and a half, basically, where we just did one a week with a few gaps here and there. And that greatly helped me because he's very knowledgeable, you know, in the Bible. And we greatly improved the proofs. And then I was going through them one proof at a time. And I got to about proof 19 and I realized, so it's going to probably take 10 or 12 years. So now this is the third attempt and I've just been redoing it 10 proofs at a time. And I'm about up to proof 40, I believe, and about to release the next video. So I'm slowly getting there. If you want to know where to find it, I have a YouTube channel. It's just Truthvids or a BitChute channel. And you can also find me on truthvids.net. That's my website. So thanks for having me, Bill, Sven. Did I answer all your questions? Sorry.
You did. That's great. And I say it's a very, very good series, the one that you did with William Fink. Perfect for people that are getting interested in Christian identity and want to learn what it's all about. It's a perfect series for beginners. So I do recommend people check that out. Did you actually use the Jeremiah legend as one of the 100 proofs the Israelites are white, or did you come across that as you were doing your research for that but didn't actually include it in the series?
In the original 100 proofs, yes. But for the new one, I didn't necessarily. I could still because I'm still going through it. But mostly I was sticking to like absolute proofs that, you know, prove the origin of the Israelites. There's lots of circumstantial evidence and there is some really interesting stuff, but I didn't think it was that important for just a small, you know, proofs, rock solid 100 proofs. You know, this is really interesting, especially but for the 100 proofs, I'm still not sure because, you know, you're trying to keep it short and concise and there's so much you could throw at people. And because it's just for newcomers, for beginners, you want to just basically just explain the basics, you know, and then perhaps they can read into, you know, things like this afterwards.
Yeah, there's a lot of legend as well involved in it. And part of what we've been looking at in this Patriotic History series has been the legends. because there's always a kernel of truth at the source of that legend. And as we'll look at today, we're looking back in time 2,500 years with this legend of Jeremiah in Ireland, and it's certainly been consistent. It stayed all that time, and hopefully we'll be able to show today that there is an element of truth to this legend. We've got various sources. We've got an article from ensignmessage.com. We've got some quotes from Wikipedia, and we've also got some quotes from Jacob's Pillar, the Stone of Destiny by E. Raymond Capps, because it also includes this stone that's in the coronation chair, the origins of this stone that all the kings of England have actually been crowned upon this chair, and before that the kings of Scotland, and before that the kings of Ireland. And it's where this stone comes from that we'll be talking about today. Patriot, I know you've been interested in this as well. You've heard of this legend and you've got an interest in it as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been following. I actually set out to kind of disprove CI at one point. I came across, in fact, a good friend of mine is a nationalist. He's not even Christian, but he linked me a video, and I started listening to it. And at the time, I was kind of like, as nationalist, but kind of still Judeo-Christian type, and trying to reconcile the perspective of universalism with nationalism. And then I came across this, and I was trying to disprove it. And the more I actually looked into it, it's like the more the scriptures actually came alive, and where you would just kind of gloss over things, suddenly they had just whole new meanings. And yeah, I just couldn't refute it. So, just my interest spiraled from there, really.
Well, this is one that I haven't concentrated on before. So this is the first time we've really looked at this, I think, at Radio Albion. And it's long overdue, basically, because it is a huge part of British history, Irish history, as well as British history. As I say, we'll begin with this article from ensignmessage.com, which is written by John E. Wall. And it's basically entitled Jeremiah in Ireland. And he says, one of the most beloved stories of traditional literature written by those who support the identity of the lost 10 tribes of Israel being the modern nations of Europe is the story of the coming of the prophet Jeremiah to Ireland. According to this story, shortly after 586 BC, when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, conquered Jerusalem, Jeremiah the prophet, accompanied by his scribe Baruch and the daughters of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, fled that country and for a short time resided in Egypt. From there they took a ship to Ireland, where one of the daughters married Jochaid the High King, or Heremon, or Ard-Ri of Ireland. A variation says that the marriage took place in Jerusalem. The royal couple governed the Emerald Isle from their capital at Tara in County Meath. Jeremiah, at that time an old man, was also reputed to have established a sort of ministerial training college at Tara, and he became a revered figure in Irish legend. So they're talking about Jeremiah here. He's also known as Olam Fodla, or I've heard that he's referred to as Olam Fodla. Have you heard that name at all, Truth Fits, associated with this? Because we're going to be looking at another character tonight in this article here. But he's also referred to as Olam Fodla, isn't he?
Yeah, I believe that's the name he went for. I believe some of the people who wrote these articles came up with possibilities of what the name meant. But yeah, it's also interesting that the name, you know, Jerry and Gerard is actually very common in Ireland, right? It's kind of passed on. I've even heard people say that Jeremiah used to be the patron saint of Ireland. I don't know if that's true until it was changed to Patrick, right? But there's definitely a lot of history and myths going around Jeremiah going back. Of course, it's always going to be ridiculed. And, you know, people will say, oh, you Brits, you think the whole world, you know, evolves around you. And of course, the throne of Israel also just happens to be in Britain. But as we go through the story, you know, that there is some evidence there, right?
Oh, definitely. And we'll see that Jeremiah was also associated with the saints as well. And sanctified. And we also have the daughter One of the daughters is linked with the name Tia Teffy and also linked with the name Scotta, which is where we get the word Scotland from in the first place. And the Irish used to be known as the Scots, and they took that name from one of these descendants of these royal princesses that were taken over from Jerusalem to Egypt and then from there into Ireland. And I expect most of the listeners are aware of the story of the tribe of Judah and when they were removed from the land of Judah and the kingly line, the line of David, the last king Zedekiah. He had his eyes put out whilst his sons were being murdered in front of him. But his daughters were removed from before that happened. They were entrusted into the care of Jeremiah. And the Hebrew law was that the line, the bloodline could pass down through one of the females, the same as the tradition is that we have in Britain. Well, as I mentioned, there's also this Stone of Destiny that's linked with this legend. Over the course of the centuries, the royal line established at Tara was transferred from Ireland to Scotland and then on to England, where it survives today in the person of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. A wondrous stone, variously called the Stone of Destiny, the Stone of Scone, or the Coronation Stone, upon which Her Majesty and her predecessors on the thrones of the three kingdoms were crowned, is thought to be the stone that the patriarch Jacob slept on at Bethel, and was also believed to have been brought to Ireland by Jeremiah. And this is a stone that you can look up on Wikipedia. And this was supposedly the stone that Jacob rested his head on when he saw a procession of angels going up and down a ladder. And he awoke from his dream and he said, well, this is a terrible place. This is a place of God. It should be called Bethel. And he anointed the stone. It was like a standing stone. And all the kings of the line of Judah after that used that stone as their coronation. So it was a very important stone. And he also apparently carried over to Ireland with him the Harp of David. And of course, that's the national symbol of Ireland, is the harp. And also the Ark of the Covenant disappeared at that time as well. And there is a legend that that was entrusted to him to look after as well. I don't know if either of you got any comments on that, Patriarch. You got any comments on that legend or about the Bethel stone?
No, just that the tradition apparently still stands today. Right, with the queen, I think we mentioned in previous podcast.
Yeah, she's still coronated on that stone. I mean, it got taken by Edward I from Scotland down to London, and then it was removed from London during the war to keep it safe. And then I think Scottish nationalists kidnapped the stone, and they took it back to Scotland, and then it was taken back to London. They gave it back. And then it was given back to Scotland, where it's now looked after in Scotland at a special abbey at Scone. And then from there, it's taken back to put on the coronation chair for the coronation. Now, actually, at the Hill of Tara in Ireland, they have a stone there, which they call the Stone of Destiny. But it only goes back 150 years. And that's the last mention of it. And it's a phallic symbol, basically. It cannot have been the Stone of Scone, the Stone of Destiny. And I think they just call it the Stone of Destiny and pretend that it's the same one because they don't like the fact that it got taken over to Scotland with the Scots in about the 5th century by Fergus, I think his name was. Truthfids, any comments on that before I read this quote by E. Raymond Capt?
Yeah, you have to wonder why would Edward I care about some silly stone, right? I mean, why would he take it and then build a throne on that stone and want to be, anointed on that stone and all following kings? That there must have been more to it. He must have known something that perhaps isn't recorded. Now, he must have had some knowledge of it. And why would a king from Ireland bring it over to Scotland and they would all anoint their kings on it? That there must be some history there, right?
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, good points there. Well, this is what Eram Capt has to say about it. In appearance, the rugged surface of the Stone of Destiny is of a steelish, dull, purplish colour, varying somewhat and with some reddish veins. It is a compound of calcareous sandstone, and embedded in it are a few pebbles, one of quartz and two others of a dark material. Its shape is roughly pillow-like, being about 26 inches in length and 16 inches in width and 10.5 inches in depth. Across its surface runs a crack, and some chisel marks are still visible on one or two sides. It appears to have been in the process of being prepared for building purposes, but was discarded before being finished. There are two large iron rings of some rust-resistant alloy, one at each end of the stone, which hang loosely from eyes made of similar metal let into the stone. The rings in the end of the stone would indicate that porter poles were once used to transport the stone. At first it would appear as if two poles were used, one of them passed through the ring at each end, so that four persons would be required to carry it. However, when turned up, these rings protrude above the top of the stone, enabling one pole to be passed through both rings across the top of the stone, theoretically allowing it to be carried by only two persons. So it's been cleverly designed, so either four people can carry it or two people can carry it, and it's obviously designed for transporting around for some reason. In preparation for King George V's coronation, the stone was temporarily removed from the coronation chair and a photograph was taken of it. This photograph disclosed that a groove runs right across the stone from ring to ring. From its appearance, this groove was not cut, but was clearly the result of friction from a single pole being passed across from ring to ring. Such an indentation and wearing away of material indicates the enormous amount of carrying that the stone was subjected to. If, as it appears, a single pole was used, because of the weight of the stone, about 336 pounds, it is probable that more than two persons actually carried the stone. Yoke-like crossbeams could have been attached to both ends of the pole for the convenience of two or more persons at each end of the pole. British, Scottish, and Irish records of the Stone of Destiny, located at Tara, Ireland, some 5 centuries before Christ, from where it was transported to Scotland circa AD 498 by Fergus the Great. From there it was taken to Iona circa AD 563, and Iona is the famous Celtic monastery, and from there to Dunstaffnage, from where it was removed to Scone near Perth, Scotland. Finally, it was moved by Edward I to Westminster Abbey, London in AD 1296. Thus, from Tara to Westminster, covering over 1800 years of history, it was never carried to any appreciable extent. The mere removal from these places could not account for the wearing away of the stone that was evidently caused by the friction of a pole used in constant carrying. This must have been the result of many months of continuous carrying prior to its arrival in Tara. The story of its journeying from Bethel in the time of Jacob and its accompanying the children of Israel in the wilderness would account for its present condition. One of the most significant facts about the Coronation Stone is that no similar rock formation exists in the British Isles. Professor Totten, the eminent professor of science at Yale University, after making a thorough examination of the stone, made the following statement. The analysis of the stone shows that there are absolutely no quarries in Scone or Iona from where a block so constituted could possibly have come, nor yet from Tara. Professor Odlum, a geologist and professor of theology at Ontario University, also made microscopic examinations of the Coronation Stone, comparing it to similar stone from Scotland, including Iona, and the quarries of Ireland, and found them to be dissimilar. Professor Odlum became tremendously interested in the stone. He was intrigued with the idea that perhaps its source could be found in Palestine, as suggested by the ancient records of Ireland. Determined to make the search, and after several weeks of unsuccessful exploration, Odlum discovered a stratum of sandstone near the Red Sea at Bethel, geologically the same as the Coronation Stone. Relating the circumstances of the discovery to a friend upon his return to Britain, the professor stated, I put on my old Macintosh, I stuck my geologist's hammer in my pocket, and I went out for one last look. It was pouring with rain. I walked along the same places I had walked over and over again, looking for stone. Suddenly, while I was walking along a certain pathway with a rocky cliff on either side, the sun shone on the rain-streaked piece of rock, and I noticed a peculiar sort of glitter that I thought I recognised. I climbed up, and I found that wet rock, as far as I could see with the magnifying glass I had, was of the identical texture I had been searching for. I chipped off a piece from the living rock. I took it back to the hotel and examined it as well as I could, and I was sure I had got what I wanted. Although a microscopic test of the sample Bethel stone matched perfectly with the same test made of the coronation stone, the professor wanted to make chemical tests of both stones to dispel all doubts as to the source of Britain's treasured relic. To save time, Odlum cabled a geologist friend in England and said, "Will you do all you possibly can to get a piece of the coronation stone, no bigger than a pea, in order that we may submit it to a chemical test?" The geologist friend made application to the Dean of Westminster Abbey to be allowed to take a piece, no bigger than a pea, from the stone. The Dean said, "I daren't let you have permission. The only way you can get permission would be from the Archbishop of Canterbury." Application was made to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and this was the reply of the Archbishop. "To take a piece from the stone no bigger than a pea would require a special Act of Parliament to be passed by the House of Commons, endorsed by the House of Lords, and signed by the King. And if you get this," said the Archbishop, "I still wouldn't give you permission." So they don't want the stone to be tampered with. And this geologist has had a look at it, and he says that it's the same as the stone that's in Palestine. And I bring this up because if you look this up on Wikipedia, they claim that it's been looked at and, it was just some common piece of stone. But it says here that it's the same. It's nothing like the stone that was around in Scone, nothing like the stone that's available in Ireland, but it is like the stone that's available in Palestine. And also this point here with this groove that's in the stone itself, and that groove could only have been put in there if it had been carried for days on end, years on end, which is apparently what was done with it when the Israelites were traipsing around the wilderness with it. You've got any thoughts on that, True Fitz?
Yeah, that's fascinating. It also sounds like a divine hand kind of nudged him in the right direction so that he would found it. So he found it so that the information would be out there. Of course, it will always be ridiculed in the mainstream, of course, right?
Yeah, and I think they deliberately don't want it to be tested. They don't want people to find out this truth. I mean, it used to be known by all the British people. It was a very common understanding that we came from Israel. We were the Israelites. That was a common understanding. I mean, if you look at the old Bibles, the King James Bibles, it refers to Britain as Israel. You know, this is why we have that the song Jerusalem, talking about building Jerusalem in the green and present land. If you look at the Treaty of Arbroath, it talks about the Scots and the Scots. And it actually times the date of the Scottish people going back to the Exodus. And if you look at the earliest British chronicles, they date what's going on in Britain to what was going on in the Holy Land at the time. And the only reason they would do that if the people in the Holy Land were part of the same tribe of people that were actually here in Britain. It's only in the last 150 years that this stuff has been ridiculed and ignored. And it's only in the last 200 years that there's actually been found archaeological evidence to prove so much of it. That's the bizarre thing. I think it was just taken for granted that that was who we were up until recently. You know, and of course, now it gets ridiculed. Patriarch, you got any thoughts on that?
Well, based on the evidence of our ancestors knowing who we were, you only have to look at the King James, the illustration for the front cover. I mean, if for example, Israel was irrelevant as part of a new covenant, then why do they have like all the kind of 12 tribes, the tents for the 12 tribes featured? You know, there's lots of little details which really kind of, you know, add confluence to the fact that, you know, we are the ancestors of Israel.
I think you can also tell by looking at the stained glass windows, can't you? You know, they're not Levantine, Middle Eastern Arab types that you see. They're all very, very Aryan looking, golden haired, rosy cheeked types that you see within these stained glass windows. That was who they imagined the Israelites to be. They didn't imagine them to be like the people that are living in the country called Israel today. Well, that was E. Raymond Capp, what he has to say about it. Moving back to this Ensign Message article, he says, "It is claimed that the story of Jeremiah coming to Ireland can be found in the ancient annals, histories and other literature of the Irish, and indeed references to it abound in the works written by traditional Ten Tribes scholars, especially 19th century writers. Yet rarely, if ever, do these writers point to any specific history in which this tale may be found. vague references to Irish and ales usually being made, a few examples will suffice. One authority states that Irish historians are unanimous that around 580 BC there arrived in Ulster a notable man, Jeremiah, a patriarch or saint accompanied by an eastern princess and a lesser person by the name of Simon Barak or Barek. Further, that Irish tradition tells us that Jeremiah married the princess Tamar Tephi to Yochaid, king of Ireland. However, the historians are not named, nor is any particular tradition cited. Another writer says that the ancient records of Ireland bear ample testimony to this, Jeremiah's coming to Ireland, as an historic fact, not only recording the event itself, but also supplying confirmatory evidence by giving the actual date or period of their arrival correctly. Again, disappointingly, this author does not name the ancient records in which the Jeremiah story may be found. Rather, we read phrases such as, the records conclude and the royal records state. He dates the coming of Jeremiah to Ireland as late in 583 BC or early 582 BC. The closest that any writer comes to naming names is a contemporary author and archaeologist, E. Raymond Capt. In his book, Jacob's Pillar, A Biblical Historical Study, Capt makes reference to the Chronicles of Erie, the Annals of the Kingdom of Ireland by the Four Masters, the Annals of Clonmacnoise, and the Chronicles of Scotland. He quotes briefly from the latter and gives an extensive recounting of the entire Jeremiah legend in his notable book. However, like the learned writers cited above, Capt does not directly cite any passage in any ancient chronicle which explicitly mentions Jeremiah. And this is a big failing with E. Raymond Capt. His sources are correct. I mean, people like William Fink have gone through his sources and gone through whole books of Herodotus to actually find out what it was that E. Raymond Capt was referring to. And it is there, but E. Raymond Capt didn't actually put the page and the chapter and exactly where it was that he was getting his sources from. And this is a problem with a lot of these researchers. You know, they read these bits and pieces in the books, but they don't actually cite exactly where it is they're getting the information from. And I'm hoping we're being quite clear in this series where we're getting our information from. And as he says here, the author here says that E. Raymond Capt is one of the best authors, but even he doesn't give proper quotations, although we see they are pretty good when we get to them. You got any thoughts on that, Truefitz?
Yeah, a lot of the British Israel authors were like that, unfortunately. They either they just reread what previous authors had read and didn't actually research it themselves. And then you had people who were very well versed in the Bible, but maybe not so much in ancient history and archaeology. And then you had people who are really good in ancient history, but not very learned in the Bible. And there's only been very few people who have spent, you know, 20 years and looked at all of it and then put the picture together. So E. Raymond Capt did do a pretty good job in that regards. But as for these books, they're very painstaking to read, right? Like, I still haven't read the Annuals of the Four Masters of Ireland. It's on my reading list. I'm going through the books you recommended, right? I'm still going through them. I've got Diodorus Siculus. I've still got to read. I've bought that. But these books are like really long and they're not like particularly interesting to read. It's just basically just listing, you know, there was a king, he died, there was a king. It's not like, for example, Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of Britain, right? That's probably one of my favorite books because it was a really fun and enjoyable read. But these books you just listed aren't, and it's very painstaking to go through them, right? It takes months.
It's hard work, isn't it? I mean, just reading Flavius Josephus is difficult, and that's a really good read. It's absolutely fascinating stuff, but that will take you about a year to get through. When you're looking through these references here that Capt is talking about, as you say, you're just looking through it for the specific reference that ties into what you're discussing here, and you could end up having to go through pages and pages worth of stuff just trying to find it, and it's not going to be very good doing a Google search either, because it may have a different spelling for the name or what have you. It is hard work. It is hard going. Well, I've got another quote from here from E. Raymond Capt talking about this. The story of Jacob's pillar may be likened to an arch, the left-hand span of which, starting at Bethel, carries us through biblical history up to the destruction of Jerusalem about 584 BC. The right-hand span of the arch begins at Westminster Abbey in Britain and reaches backwards to Tara in Ireland. Just after 584 BC, the keystone, upon which the story rests, is the first overturning contained in Ezekiel's prophecy, chapter 21, verse 27, that takes the stone from Jerusalem after the city's destruction in Tara. And I'm hoping you'll be able to tell us a bit about these prophecies in a moment, Truefits. From Bethel to Westminster is a long distance in both time and space. Any attempt to connect the two involves the necessity of reconstructing a consecutive, feasible story. There is a tradition that has subsisted from time immemorial and is quoted in official guides that the Stone of Scone set in the coronation throne in Westminster Abbey is none other than that on which the head of Jacob rested when he dreamed of the ladder with angels ascending and descending upon it. Is this just an interesting fable? Traditions do not spring from nothing, and this one is at least worthy of impartial examination. The arrival in Ireland of the Bethel Stone rests upon the authority of the ancient records of Ireland and the traditions which abound there. Here let us understand that the ancient historical legends of Ireland are, generally speaking, far from being baseless myths. The Irish people are a people who eminently cling to tradition. Not only were the great happenings that marked great epochs enshrined in their memory forever, but even little events that trivially affected the history of their race were and are seldom forgotten. The Irish poets and Senaki, the historian of the remotest antiquity, were honoured next to the king because of the tremendous value which the people set upon the recording and preserving of their history. The poet and the historian, following the fashion of the time, took advantage of their artist's privilege to colour their narrative to an extent that to the modern mind would seem fantastic, but it was with the details of the story that they were granted this liberty. The big essential facts had to remain unaltered. The things of importance no poet of repute, however highly he might colour, could or would dare to falsify. However strange are the storyteller's descriptions of ancient tradition, when examined carefully, they provide substantial links which give credence to the basic truth of the traditions. The modern part of the story, from Westminster back to Ireland, rests on a succession of well-authenticated Irish, Scottish and English historical documents which may be regarded as practically undisputed. Writers on the subject, quoting from such works as the Chronicles of Erie, the Annals of the Four Masters, the Annals of Clonmacnoise, etc., locate the stone originally at Tara, County Meath, Ireland. Naturally, such early records as these are uncertain as to dates, but from the manuscript Cambrensis Eversus by Dr. Lynch, published in Latin in 1662 and translated in 1848, the year circa 584 BC may be taken as the Tara starting date. Scota was one of the earliest names of Ireland, so named, it is said, from Scota, the daughter of the Pharaoh, one of the ancient female ancestors of the Milesians. These people were commonly called Scoti or Scots, both terms being frequently used by early Latin historians and poets. The Irish legends also relate how this same Scota, while in Egypt, married Gallo or Gaethelus, a Miletus or Milesian chieftain, and that from this union the kings of Tara were descended. The marriage is said to have occurred during the reign of a pharaoh who was drowned in the Red Sea. This would have been the pharaoh Hophra, who provided refuge to Jeremiah and the daughters of Zedekiah, and who was later murdered in his boat in 566 BC. The Chronicles of Scotland by Hector Bowes, translated into Scottish by John Belladon, 1531, tell us the ancestor of the Scots was an Greek called Gaethelus, father of Jochaid the Heremon, son, or sometimes said to denote a descendant, of Cecrops, or Calcol of Athens, other wariwise of Argus, king of Argives, who came to Egypt when in this time reigned in Egypt Pharaoh, ye scourge of ye people of Israel. Gaethelus gained a great victory for Pharaoh against the Morris and people of Yined, and King Pharaoh gave him his daughter, called Scotta, in marriage. And that's from Volume 1, page 21 to 27. Neither the name or surname of Pharaoh is given, but the word Pharaoh is the Egyptian term for king or monarch, and the fact that the records called Scotta the Pharaoh's daughter is proof that they knew her as merely the king's daughter. The Chronicles of Scotland continue the story of Gaethlus, recording that he left Egypt with his wife, Scotta, his friends, and a company of Greeks and Egyptians, rather that to abide ye manifest vengeance of God, or reference to God's judgment on the remnant that had fled to Egypt to escape Nebuchadnezzar, and travelling by the Mediterranean Sea after long time, he landed in one part of Spain called Lusitan, later called Portingal. After this, he built the city of Brigance and called his subjects Scotties, in honour and affection of his wife. And peace having been secured, Gaethlus sitted in his chair of marble within his city. This chair of marble had such fortune and omen that wherever it was found in any land, the same land shall become the native land of the Scots. The Scotties shall joyous and broke the landis hail, where you find it, but gif weirdis fail. Translation, the Scots shall brook that realm as native ground, if words fail not wherever this chair is found. It should be noted that the Student's English Dictionary defines marble as any species of calcareous stone susceptible of a good polish. It is reasonable to assume the marble chair referred to was the coronation stone or the Bethel stone, still in the hands of the sons or descendants of Jacob when in the care of Gaethlus and his queen Scotta. And many of the ancient Irish records, when making reference to an Eastern king's daughter, also mention an old man, a patriarch, a saint or a prophet, called Olam Fodla, and his scribe or companion called Simon Brook, Brack, Brack, Berek or Barak, as it is variously spelled. Reputedly, they carried with them many ancient relics. Among these were a harp, an ark, a chest, and a stone called in Gaelic the Lia Fail, meaning the stone of fate or the hoary of destiny. Tradition asserts that Olam Fodla was none other than Jeremiah the prophet, that the king's daughter was the heir of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. Simon Brook or Baruch was Jeremiah's scribe, who figures prominently in biblical history, and the harp was the one belonging to King David. The ark or chest was the Ark of the Covenant, and finally, that the stone, the Lia Fail, was the stone that Jacob anointed with oil at Bethel. So we don't just have the references there, these Irish references. We also have this Scottish reference, which goes into quite some detail and talks about them being the descendants of Cecrops from Athens. And Cecrops is one of the sons of Zarajuda. Cecrops was the one that started off Troy and that kingly line. So I think what it's saying here is this line here that came from Cecrops, that was Gaethlus that married the daughter that married the king's daughter. So that's when you had the line of Zara marrying into the line of Pharaohs. I guess that's where that bit would come from. Any thoughts on that, Truthfids?
Yeah, so basically you have Judah, who had twin sons, right? Pharaohs and Zara. And Zara's hand came out first, then it comes back, and then Pharaohs comes out, right? And Pharaohs received the birthright. And we don't really know what happened to Zara's sons, right? Zara actually stayed with the Israelites, but when he came out of the Exodus, he's got no sons with him. So it seems that his sons didn't accept that they probably argued, no, we should have the birthright. And they seem to have dispersed and went to Greece. So all these kingdoms set up. Of course, this was the plan of God, because he wanted to scatter a portion of Israelites as well. So yeah, what you were saying, you know, that Athens was set up by one son, Troy was set up by another son, and the Malaysians were another branch from Zara, right? So when it says the Malaysians came to Egypt and then went to Ireland, they were actually Israelites as well. And I believe there's another legend that Jeremiah had Carians with him, mercenaries. Well, the Carians were Phoenicians, so they were Israelites as well. And there's another more detailed part of the legend where Jeremiah first went to Spain, then to Cornwall, He spoke to the King of England, and then the King sent him to Ireland, basically. So you know, a king coming from the Malaysians to Egypt, then probably to Spain or Gaul, and then to England. You know, it's entirely possible, right?
Well, that's interesting. That confirms that as well, isn't it? You're saying there that Milesians can be traced back to Zara. Gaethulus was one of these Milesians. And then we have the Scottish reference there to Gaethulus being descended from Calcol, who was descended, as we know, was descended from Zara. So that's, you know, that's another confirmation of what you're saying there, isn't it?
Yeah. And I also just wanted to say that there was a promise to David that his throne would be forever, right? That there would always be a king. And if the throne was ended at when Jerusalem fell, right, by the Babylonians, which would be about, say, 587 BC, let's just say 600 BC, roughly, right? Then where's the king? How did God keep his promise? Because if the throne ended, then the promise is broken. There's not a king of, you know, David there anymore, is there? And if you say, well, Christ is, you know, he's the king and he's the replacement and he's keeping the throne, well, there's still that 600-year gap, right? So if there wasn't a king from the time when Jerusalem fell to Christ, 600 years, where was the throne then? For God to keep his promise, the line must have continued somewhere, right? There must have been a king of David, a descendant of David somewhere. So we have to ask where, and this Irish legend fits perfectly, right?
Well, it does. It's completely. And also there's this prophecy as well of a stone being overturned. Do you know something about that? The cap was on about there at the beginning of the quote about the stone being overturned.
Yeah, that's in Ezekiel. And he's actually speaking against Zedekiah. I might as well read it. It's just a very short quote. And thou profane, wicked prince of Israel, whose day is come when iniquity shall have an end. So that's Zedekiah. Thus saith the Lord God, remove the diadem and take off the crown. So he's stripping Zedekiah of the throne of David. But at the same time, he's got to keep the promise, right? This shall not be the same. So the throne's going to be different. Exalt him that is low and abase him that is high. So that kind of indicates somewhere else, you know, a lowly throne is going to be elevated, and that would be Britain. And then he says, I will overturn it, and then it shall be no more until we come whose right it is, and I will give it to him. And people have said, well, that's the overturn from Jerusalem first to Ireland, then to Scotland, then to England, the three turns. And then finally it will end, right? And there's evidence that, you know, that the British thrones, they've intermixed now. They're not a pure bloodline anymore. So, and in Revelation, it says the keys to David have fallen towards the end, indicating that eventually the throne would be lost. And sorry, just to finish Ezekiel, until he come whose right it is, and I will give it to him. And that would be Christ, right? So Christ is going to return to reclaim the throne. So basically, recently, the royal bloodline of England have debased their bloodline, right, by intermixing. And that would be the indication that it shall be no more until he who come whose right is. And that would be Christ. When he returns, he will reclaim the throne, right?
So it all fits in with prophecy, with this overturning of the throne, and yet with the throne continuing. And then there's the proof of the prophecy that you've got these Milesians, this Milesian prince Gedaliah, who marries the daughter of Zedekiah, and then you've got the two together. And then you've got the smaller kingship, which would have been in Ireland, and then Britain, that gets raised up, and the big kingship, which was in Jerusalem, has been destroyed. But God's still got to keep his promise that there'll always be a throne. So that's what keeps the throne going, basically. So it all ties in and makes sense. Patriarch, you got any comments you want to make on that?
I was wondering, a question for Truthvids, who would suggest the monarchy today has intermingled with. Would you say maybe the Edomites, that line in some way, shape or form?
Yeah, basically, you know, with all the revolutions and the way the power of the monarchies and the nobles was waning, a lot of them got poverty stricken, and they all basically started marrying, you know, rich merchants to prop up, you know, their finance. And the same happened with the monarchies. So I believe King Philip would be one, right?
Okay.
So they ended up getting poor, and they ended up forgetting the fact that they should only be marrying within their own caste, and they ended up marrying outside of their caste. It used to be such an important thing, was that you married who you were told to marry, and you stuck within your caste. And there's a fable in the Book of the Danes which refers to that, and it refers to somebody marrying out of their caste, and the offspring really resents the person from the upper caste because they married down. And they really look up to the mother because the mother married up, basically. And that book is a thousand years old. And that's the Book of the Danes. Again, it's talking about the tribe of Dan. And we'll hear about the tribe of Dan here that are involved in England. Well, this lack of corroboration that we were referring to amongst these authors for the Jeremiah legend has caused some to doubt the validity of the entire story. But I will show in this article that Jeremiah is mentioned in the Irish annals and histories, albeit under another name. His Judahite ancestry and prophetic identity are clearly stated, and even a brief physical description is given. His friend and amanuensis Baruch is also mentioned. Furthermore, I will name names and give the reader of this article the references by which he may corroborate the story himself. And in, along with this podcast, we'll publish the notes, and all the references are there so people can go and check the references for themselves. First, however, in order to understand the proper chronological context of Jeremiah's coming to Ireland, a brief review of Irish history prior to his arrival is necessary. And I'll just pause there. Isn't there an apocryphal book to do with Baruch the scribe? Is there a book accredited to him? Do you know, Truthfids?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's the same, you know, a scribe of Jeremiah, because the names in you know, Hebrew and Israelites, they would often repeat the names. You know, there would be, you know, like there's so and so son of Moses, and it's not the Moses. It was just people kept reusing the names. But yeah, there was an apocryphal book, but it's probably not the same guy as the you know, scribe of Jeremiah.
Right, and that was the guy that accompanied Jeremiah. Well, let's take a look at the history of Ireland prior to Jeremiah. Admittedly, the history of this ancient land can at times be confusing. It is said that the Irish like nothing so much as a good story, and their willingness to romanticise and embellish has led to a certain confusion. On the other hand, it is not entirely their fault. Much of the blame can be laid at the feet of Catholic monks who altered the traditional Irish histories or invented their own in order to deliberately hide the Israelite ancestry of the Irish people. For instance, they attempted to portray the Irish as descendants of Magog, son of Japhet. Irish history begins, as the history of every civilization does, after the flood of Noah's day. For 300 years after that catastrophic event, Ireland was an uninhabited land. A claim to sovereignty over Ireland was made, according to historian Herman L. Hoare, who refers to Irish annals, by the Assyrian king Ninus, son of Bel, but the land was not colonised permanently. And that's taken from the Compendium of World History by Hoare. And some of the listeners might think, well, this is surprising. This is all legend, talking about history after the flood of Noah. But if you look back at all the oldest histories, the British histories, that's what they talk about. They talk about after the flood. Now, we know that the flood was localized. I mean, we did an episode of Patriotic History looking at it, the localized flood that was in Mesopotamia. But at that time, Britain and Northern Europe really wasn't settled at all. It was only the coastlands that had people living in them. And the copper mines in Cornwall weren't being tapped into by that time. And it's entirely plausible that somebody from Assyria did make their way over to Ireland and laid a claim to it, but didn't actually colonise the place. I mean, we know the first people that came over to Cornwall to the tin mines, they were the Assyrians, and they were the first people that learned how to extract the tin in order to make the bronze. So this ties in with that, with the first record that we have of people coming over to the Britannic Isles, being the Assyrians. And it says here, this oldest Irish annals say that the first guy to make this claim was Ninus, son of Bel. And I think L.A. Waddell also talked about an Assyrian king making his way to Ireland. I don't know if you know anything about that legend at all, Truefids?
Not that legend. I wasn't sure of that. I'm not the best on all the Irish history, right? I've still got to read the book. But I just wanted to say that the ancient historians often got a bit mixed up with the whole flood timeline. And that's because there's two timelines, right? There's the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. And basically, the Masoretic is the Hebrew. It was the ancient Bible, the Old Testament written in Hebrew, and the Septuagint was the Greek version, right? They went over to Egypt, I believe it was about 200 BC, and they translated it all to Greek. And then when these different translations got separated, somehow the Hebrew timeline got corrupted slightly. And unfortunately, most people in Europe followed that timeline. And that's why you get these ridiculous timelines, like the Assyrians came over 300 years after the flood, right? And that's not possible, because just an example, in the Masoretic timeline, so that's the Greek, it's about 2,000 years between the flood and Abraham, whilst the Septuagint, it's only like...
So there's quite a difference there. I mean, if you're talking about the Assyrians as well, the Assyrian Empire, I mean, that was started by Asher, and that wasn't until some time after the first empire that was started by Cush. And then you had Nimrod, the mighty hunter, didn't you? And then you had the Akkadian Empire, and then you had the Assyrian Empire after that. So probably about 1,000 years after the flood. So this 300 year estimation, that's what it's got to be down to, is the difference between the Masoretic text and the Septuagint. Well, in 2069 BC, and again, we have to look at that and say and ask whether that's Masoretic or Septuagint. According to Hoare, who uses Geoffrey Keating's History of Ireland as his source, a Hebrew named Partalon with his followers settled the land and established a kingdom, the country being divided into four parts after his death. The date, however, is open to some question. The PRT in the name Partalon can be equated with the BRT of the Hebrew Brit or Covenant, but then it is difficult to see how this could have referred to a descendant of Abraham who had not yet even been born. Moreover, as one authority states, the Partalonian story is clearly a variant of that of the eponymous ancestor of the British, Brutus, in Greek Pirutus, the Trojan, with which it has been confused. Brutus arrived in Britain 1103 BC, according to one scholar. Others claim an earlier date, 1149 BC. If this is so, then the date of 2069 BC is impossible. The same source quoted above claims that Partalon was a Milesian. And I think L.A. Waddell says that PRT can also stand for Phoenician. He's got another word that this Brit comes from. And Partalon, I'm certain this King Partalon, he didn't just go to Scotland, Ireland rather, he actually made his way into Scotland. And L.A. Waddell has translated a stone that was written in Phoenician, which refers to this Partalon, this King Partalon. So he's referred to in quite a few ancient documents, but it can't have been 2000 BC. And again, there's questions over whether Brutus arrived in 11,000 BC or whether he arrived in 6,000 BC, and exactly what date the Trojan War was. Because when it talks about the Trojan War and Aeneas being the father of Brutus and the Roman Empire, that kind of only happened in about the 6th or the 7th century, because the Greeks didn't even know how to write until the 5th century. So yet we're told that it happened in the 11th century BC. So I'm of the opinion that perhaps there were two Trojan Wars, and they both maybe got blended together, and elements of each got put into the one storyline. And that's my theory on it. Anyway, are your thoughts on this Partalon or the Trojan War and how that ties in, Truefids?
Yeah, I think that the timeline kind of makes sense. If the Trojan War was about 1200 BC, and then Aeneas, maybe I'm mispronouncing that, he came to Italia, right? Alba Longa, I believe. And then from there, Brutus came, and Brutus would have arrived, what, 50 to 100 years later, because he was one or two generations later. So it kind of adds up, right? And then I do believe there were multiple waves, you know, to Ireland and to Scotland, and some of these kings have kind of got mixed up, and one definitely came with Jeremiah, and then there were later ones as well, right? Because when you look at Anatolia, right, that would be West Turkey today and Greece. As I said, there were the Milesians and the Carians, and then there were constant wars, right? The Ionian empires, that's when Athens started to expand. And then you had the Persian Empire. And then after that, the Athenians reconquered West Anatolia again. And this was driving out a lot of those Phoenicians and Milesians, right? So it makes sense that around 600 to anywhere between 600 to 400 BC, that you would get these waves, you know, getting out of there and saying, well, where can we go? And then they'd end up in the British Isles, right?
Well, yeah, I guess because you had this Assyrian invasion of that area as well, and then the Babylonian invasion, they would have all been displaced and made it to the northern reaches of Europe. Patriarch, yeah, any thoughts on the Partholonians or what we've just been discussing there?
Well, with the tin trade, obviously it seemed like a likely place to gravitate to. So kind of makes sense that they would try and migrate towards there.
Definitely somewhere where there was a civilization already and where there was resources. In any event, the Partholonians, whoever they may have been, ruled Ireland intermittently until 1709 BC, when a tragedy befell them at the hands of the Phoenician Fomorians. The island was then invaded by Numidians from Scythia, who lived in Ireland until 1492 BC, being ruled by the Fomorians for much of this period. A portion of the Numidians escaped during their sojourn in the land and returned in 1492 BC as the Firbolgs. And I have to say, I think that all those dates are far too early. I think they would have been much later than that, maybe 500 years later than that. I think that's got to be down to the Masoretic text. Would you say truth, Fitz? I mean, 1492, the Scythians coming in to Ireland? What do you think?
Yeah, and I think all the Irish annuals, I read somewhere that there, a lot of them, you know, centuries ago, they tried to date all this, and someone worked out that everything was off by 500 years. And if you just moved it forward 500 years, it would all kind of make sense, right? I mean, you had the Firbolgs, as you had said, you had the Tuatha Dé Danann, right? The Danans could have got displaced by the Dorians invasion, where, you know, the Spartans descend from. They invaded Greece and a lot of the Danans were driven out. So maybe some of them ended up in Ireland. And then you had the Milesians who came and they conquered the Danans. And then you had constant waves, right? And you ended up with these kind of four kingdoms in Ireland, and then a high king as well. So technically five. And if you look at the Irish shield, you can kind of see like Israelite symbols, right? You have the eagle in one, you have the harp of David. How did that get there? You know, these must have been Israelite tribes who some kept some of their heraldry, right? And some of their identity, and maybe some of them eventually forgot it, but it's definitely still there, right?
Well, you can't say that's a coincidence, can you? You know, an eagle there and a harp, you know, two prominent Israelite symbols. I mean, that's not just, they're not both going to appear on the same heraldry by chance, are they? And that 500 years, I say that fits in with my rough estimate of just, you know, just looking at it now and thinking, well, that looks about 500 years out. Well, in 1456 BC, a contingent of the famous Tuatha, pronounced Tua Dé Danann, the tribe of Dan, arrived in Ireland and ruled for 440 years until 1016 BC. A second contingent came in 1213 BC during the days of Deborah and Barak. So we've got another Barak name there, which is from Judges chapter 5, verse 17. Finally, in 1016 BC, towards the end of the reign of King David of Israel, another Hebrew people, the Milesians, descendants of Eber the Hebrew, according to Hoa, conquered the Danites or the Danun, forcing them to accept their rule. The kingdom of Ireland was then divided between the two sons of Milesius, Eber, and Gede, the Heremon or High King, and a capital was established at Tobrad, also known as Timur, Tamer, Timara, and now called Tara. And that fits in with Tamar. Like you have the River Tamar in Cornwall. Tamar is a famous Judahite name, Hebrew name. And I was reading, I'm not sure if it's in these notes or somewhere else, that if you transliterate the Hebrew into Irish, you end up from Tamar to Tara. So it's the same name. Had you heard that at all, True Foods?
No, I hadn't heard that. But, you know, I do know that Ireland used to be called Hibernia, right? Which it basically is Heber, right? And Ireland used to be Iberia or Hiberia as well, right? And that's from the actual name Eber, because in Hebrew, all names had a meaning as well, that they weren't necessarily naming it after their ancestor Eber, which can be pronounced Heber, Hebrew. It's because Eber means the other side. And to the Phoenicians, the other side of the Mediterranean was Spain. And from Spain, the other side was Ireland, right? If you just went north. And that's why they very likely got these names. And the proof is that over the Caucasus Mountains, the other side was also called Iberia, right? And when the Scythians and Israelites migrated over, they called that the other side. And it goes the same if you're traveling by boat, right?
It's interesting with that word Hebrew. I think E. Raymond Capp says that it was Phoenician for colonizer as well. So they're all sort of words that are tied in together. The other side, colonizing a new land, and then the people themselves were known as Hebrews. Well, throughout all these invasions, the Irish have meticulously maintained the records of their kings. Lists of these kings can be found in Geoffrey Keating's History of Ireland, O'Flaherty's O'Gigia, and A.M.H.J. Stockfish's Manuel de Histoire, Volume 2, pages 234 to 235. That's like the Welsh. They've meticulously recorded all the names of their kings as well, but then you get sort of mixed up with the exact dates. So the kings, the list of the kings are correct, but when they were trying to date them, because back then they didn't have BC and they didn't have AD, you were lucky if you could date something by referring to Caesar. I think most of our dates in history go back to one of the Egyptian king lists. So it is notoriously hard to actually get the exact correct dates, but we do know the names of these kings. Now, for our purposes here, however, the royal line that most concerns us is that of Nemed, reputed ancestor of the Hebrew people who invaded Ireland in 1709 BC. His royal descendants are listed in various sources, sometimes differently, yet they are important to our story because it is in this genealogy, whether always precisely accurate or not, that we find Jeremiah in Irish history, although under another name. Throughout this article, I've tried to pursue my objective, that of identifying Jeremiah in Irish history, in a manner that is easy for the reader to understand. The history of Ireland is confusing enough as it is without bringing in legends, fables, and tales of bravery and romance by the heroes of this holy land in the Atlantic. For this reason, I will confine myself to a discussion of Nemed and his reputed descendants, one in particular whom I will identify with the biblical Jeremiah. So remember, Nemed is one of the ancestors of the Hebrew people. He supposedly invaded Ireland in 1709 BC, and it's in amongst his descendants that we hear about Jeremiah. Historian Geoffrey Keating, writing of the expedition of Nemed to Ireland in 34 ships with a crew of 30 in each ship, said that this party of colonisers was led by Nemed and his four sons, Stain, Larbanel the prophet, Einind, and Fergus Leth Derg, or Fergus of the Red Side. In the Annals of Clonmacnoise, and that's the one that's referred to by E. Raymond Capt, the same four sons are named in a different order. The father is called Nui Makavgenemnon. With his four sons came into Ireland out of Greece. His sons' names also were Sedan, Joannel or Labanel, the prophet, Fergus Leodurg, and Anion, which people ruled Ireland 382 years. Another historical source, the Leovar Gavala, or the Book of Conquests, agrees, adding that Yarbanel the prophet was a Numidian chief. Although Yarbanel is called a son of Nemed, this need not literally be true. It simply means he is a descendant of Nemed. The account reads, "Now as for Nemed, he had four chiefs with him, Stain, Yarbanel the prophet, Fergus Redside, and Aenion. They were the four sons of Nemed." Still another account names Nemed the ancestor of the Danans. Keating writes, "Some antiquarians say that the nation, of whom we are now treating, were called Tuatha de Danann, from Brian, Yakar, and Yakaba, the three sons of Dana, daughter of Delbeth, son of Elithan, son of Naiad, son of Inde, son of Alay, son of Tath, son of Tabam, son of Ender or Enna, son of Beothak, son of Ibiath, son of Bethak, son of Yarbanel, son of Nemed." And again, I'll just pause there because it shows you how important ancestry was. You had to say who you were, who your fathers were. And again, that's something that we see with the Hebrews and with the Levites. And race was all important back then, and who you were descended from. You needed to be able to recite your descendants going back 10 generations to show that they were free men, to show that you were entitled to the respect and the honour that was due to a member of the tribe or whatever caste that you were. We find an echo of this in the Leovar Gabala, naming the same names as above, except that Elithan is called the son of Delbeth, and also that Yarbanel the prophet is the son of Nemed, son of Agnoman, and Agnoman is an obvious reference to Agamemnon, the king of the Greek Mycenae, who led an expedition against the Trojans to recover Helen, wife of Agamemnon's brother Menelaus, the king of Sparta. So again, we have another link with Troy there. Two other figures from Irish history, Brez of the Danann and Nuad Silverarm, claimed descent from Nemed. And Yarbanel is mentioned in both genealogies as a son of Nemed. The Milesians also figure into this tale, but we will have more on that later. All this not be as confusing as it looks, as there is a common thread running through all these genealogies. Whether we speak of Nemedians, Firbolgs, who were another branch of the Nemedians, Danans, or Milesians, all of these people were Hebrews. As the Nemedians preceded the other peoples, it is clear that the Irish historians have attempted to trace the lineage of their kings to this island's earliest Hebrew ancestors. But still, we have not identified Jeremiah in Irish history. Or have we? Actually, we have stumbled across his name several times already, without recognising it, and the next section will positively identify Jeremiah in the annals of ancient Ireland. So this is why they're talking about the Numidians, because they were the earliest ones, and they were all Hebrews. So when they're talking about Jeremiah as being a son of Numidian, they're basically identifying him as a Hebrew. And the reference to Jeremiah here is, of course, this Yarbanel the prophet, who we'll talk about some more in the next episode. Any thoughts on that, True Fids? And I also think we'll probably pause this and we'll make a second episode out of this. But before we do that, do you want to make any comments on that or anything else that we've discussed tonight before we finish?
Yeah, I think that it's very easy when looking back thousands of years to muddle up, different waves of migrants, even if they're like one or two centuries apart, because you're looking so far back. And Jeremiah couldn't have been associated with the Numidians because they were way too early, right?
Yeah, so he was still descended from them, and that was why they were putting these Numidians in.
Yeah, he was related to them, right?
Yeah, he was one of their much later descendants.
If you read the opening of Jeremiah, it just says that he was a priest. He would be a Levite priest in the territory of Benjamin, right? The Levites were scattered among the kingdom, but they were all descended from either, Moses, Aaron, or the other two, right?
Well, we'll see later on that he was actually descended from Aaron, and also that would have meant that he was sanctified, and that would also have given him this saint status. And we'll see that these records of this Yarbanel the prophet, he was given that status, this saintly status as well. I mean, there's a lot of proof here that this Yarbanel is actually Jeremiah. That's where he fits into this Irish history. Patriarch, have you got any final thoughts on all of this before we finish today?
No, this is all just lots of deep learning for me. So I'm just here taking it in.
Well, if you've got any questions about it or anything that you dig up for next week, you know, I'm sure we'll be interested to hear it.
Yeah, I will definitely be going over this and bring something next week.
And I'll say, well, thank you very much for coming on today, Patriot.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Truthvids.
Thank you, Sven. Thanks as always.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.